Today is April 1st, Sunday morning, almost there at Pesach, and we are hoping now to go over the quiz for Perek Bet Mishnah Hey, and then to go on to learn Mishnayot Vav Zayin and Chet 6, 7, 8 to finish up the second Perek of Brachot. So here we are with the quiz. You just go around the room with the vocabulary. I guess Yaakov begins. Chatan.
Groom.
The groom. That's great. Patur.
Exempt.
That's great. Nasa.
Marriage.
That's great. In our context, it means it's a verb, right? Married. He married. It literally means to lift up, to exalt. But in our context, it means to lift a woman into marriage. Next word is limatanu.
Taught us.
Right. Taught us. You taught us. It's a verb again. Next one is eini.
I did not.
It's a ein ani. It's a contraction of ein ani. Not me. I didn't. Just like Steve said. Next one is levatel.
To cancel. To nullify.
That's great. Next one is mimini.
From me.
From me. That's great. Malchut.
So it's like yoke or malchus.
Malchut Shemaim, right? So what does Malchut mean?
Melech. It's from Melech.
Kingdom, I mean.
It's yeah, very good, kingdom. Okay. Next word is Pa'am.
Pass.
Next, Pa'am.
Time.
Pa'amachat, one time, once upon a time. Next word is Kimidume.
Seems.
Worked that well. Steve and I talked about that word before 10 minutes ago.
What was that?
That was from the Tosefta. You might not have gotten to it in Haruta.
Is it like?
It seems like. It seems like. It appears to me. Apparently. And the next word is also from the Tosefta. For Paul, Nitya Ashu.
I just learned it. Despaired.
Despaired, right. Despaired. Gave up. And the next word is also from the Tosefta, but we've learned from other contexts as well. Asukim. Let's make room for Martin. Asukim. We get to Yaakov, I think.
Well, it's business, engaged.
Engaged, right. Like la'asuk b'divrei Torah, to be engaged in the words of Torah. They were asukin. B'tzarchei tzibur, that was what the Tosefta said. They were busy in, the next word, tzarchei tzibur, will have pity on Martin. We won't immediately hit him with the word.
Which one?
We're not going to hit you with it, don't worry.
Tzarchei tzibur, tzibur I got no trouble with. Tzarchei, I got trouble with.
Is it needs of the community?
Needs of the community.
Yes.
Okay. Right? If you remember, there are three prayers we say after the Haftaran Shabbat. Yikum Purkan in two forms, and the third one is when we praise and thank those who are leaders of the community for being Oskei B'Tzarchei Tzibur, dealing with the needs of the community all the time. The next word is Chama.
Is it dawn?
You're close, but you're wrong. Well, what makes the dawn?
Oh, the sun.
The sun, the chama, it's hot. Chama, from language ham. And the last word is...
Is the root sun or hot?
We don't talk about a root, really, because we're talking about a noun, but the word ham means hot, and chama is a form that means the hot ball up there in the sky. Harim.
Mountains.
Right, it said that they saw the sun al rashei ha'arim. They saw the sparkling of the sun on the tops of the hills, and they knew that it was already too late to say Shema, if we're holding by the opinion that the last time to say it is Hanetzach Hama. And again, that was from the Tosefta, which we didn't really go over too much in the class, but some of you saw it in Haruta last time. Okay, so now Musagei Yisod, basic concepts. We got to Steve, what is the meaning of the phrase Ma'asei Bi?
It's like an introduction to a story.
Right.
Once upon a time.
Right. Ma'asei b'Rabban Gamliel, a story about Rabban Gamliel. Ma'asei b'Sharei Tefillah, a story about Sharei Tefillah. Define the term, got to Paul, Tosefta.
I don't know specifically.
Okay. Yaakov.
It's the Gemaras that were not included by Rav in his in the Talmud.
There's something right and something wrong that you said.
Well, he didn't do the Talmud. He did the Mishnah, right?
And who is he?
Rabbi Yehuda ben Anasi.
Rabbi Yehuda Anasi. Right, so now that's pretty good. So the Tosefta is a part of the Torah Sheval Peh that was not included in the Mishnah of Rabbi Yehuda Anasi. All of the material that Rabbi Yehuda Anasi did not include in the Mishnah is called Breitot, which means external. And of that external material, some of it was organized in a book called the Tosefta. And we said that book is organized in parallel fashion to the Mishnah. Just like the Mishnah has tractates and has prakim, so also does the Tosefta have the same tractates and many of the same prakim.
So part of the Torah Shebel Pen not included?
So it's two stages. Two stages in the definition of Tosefta. One is all the material that wasn't included in the Mishnah is called Breita. Stage two, some of the Breitot were organized in parallel form to the Mishnah in a book called Tosefta, which means an addition to the Mishnah, Tosefet to the Mishnah.
Is that Tosefta, the compilation of the of the Breitas by Rabbi Yehuda Anasi or
no,
someone else?
No, it was much, much later. Much, much later in Jewish history, in the time of the Gemara. The Riyut.
So just for the text, but if you just take the word, Tosefta means addition.
Right.
And Breitas.
Breitas means external.
External.
By the way, just something kind of funny. David just pointed out the word Tosefta means additional, well, like supplementary. It can also have, in different contexts, the connotation of kind of unnecessary, eran. So the Toseftan, same word, is the part of the body that's superfluous. So what organ of the body is called the Toseftan, do you think?
Appendix.
The appendix is Toseftan. So if you can remember it like that. Okay. On what night did they ordinarily get married in Talmudic times? I guess you weren't here last time.
I'm not here last time, but I've been to enough weddings on a Tuesday.
Fell in the trap. Today, people say we get married on Tuesday because it says, you know, in the Torah, Pamayim Kitob. The words Kitob was a good day are used twice on the third day, but not twice on the other days. But in Talmudic times, they didn't go for this fluff stuff. They did things halachically. And why did they get married on... I did not say this last time. They got married on Wednesday nights because they wanted to get married the night before the Beit Din was sitting. Beit Din always sits on Monday and Thursday. So you could either get married Sunday night or Wednesday night. Sunday night is too close to Shabbat. There's no time to prepare the Suda. You can't prepare Friday because where you do all the food on Shabbat. And then you'd only have Sunday morning and the wedding would be Sunday night. That's too close. That's not enough time to prepare the Suda, so they had to get married on Wednesday nights. Both have time to prepare the Suda, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and to be able to immediately go to the Beit Din the next day if they didn't like their wife. If things didn't work out in the marriage.
Welcome to Las Vegas.
Yeah. That's another discussion. So anyway, they got married Wednesday nights. What is the meaning of the halachic rule? Osek b'mitzvah patur min mitzvah. I guess that brings us to Bernie.
Literally, if you're busy in a mitzvah, you're exempt from a mitzvah. One mitzvah at a time, basically, right?
Right. And
we had that this morning.
In Mishnah Berurah.
Ah, really?
Doing the same. I mean, it's overlapping a lot.
Yeah, right. Yes. Yeah. Right, that's very good. And in our case, in our Mishnah, Rabbi Gamliel was exempt from saying the Shema on his wedding night as an extension of Osek B'mitzvah Patur Mitzvah. It's not that he was immediately Osek B'mitzvah of whatever it is, consuming the marriage, getting married, Peru or Vu, whatever it might be that we talked last time, but he was preparing mentally for the mitzvah. That's an extension of Osek B'mitzvah Patur Mitzvah. The extension is called Tirda de Mitzvah, the preoccupation of the mitzvah, Tirda, to be Tarud. He's not doing it yet, but he's thinking about doing it. And even that exempts him from saying Shema. Okay, and that brings us to the content of the passage, Tochen HaSugya, and brings us to David. What is the... I'm sorry. Oh, but I just answered the question for you. I'm sorry. Katan Patur Mikriyat Shema. Why? We just said why. Because he is in Tirda de Mitzvah, preoccupied with the Mitzvah. So we'll go to the next question for David. How might the point of our Mishnah be related to the previous Mishnah and to the first Mishnah of the chapter?
Because they also deal with the problem of Kavana saying Shema.
Right, that's true.
And focusing on it.
Right, that's true. I'd go further than that, though. Go further than that, and not just to say they deal with it, but how they deal with it. In other words, both the first Mishnah of the Perek and the Mishnah previous to one we're learning right now, which is Dalet, and the one we're learning right now, Hey, they all deal with the interface or possible conflict or tension between Shema on the one hand and human relations, community building, doing what you're supposed to do in the physical world. In the previous Mishnah, you're on the top of the tree picking apples or putting a layer of stones there. In the first Mishnah of the Perek, you have to, you want to, in a position in which you would say hello to people, say goodbye to people, or greet people. And now in Mishnah, you're getting married. All matters of building community bonds, or being involved in the community, working, talking, creating connections, creating marriage is the basis of all community connections. And the question is, what's the relationship between these community connections, human connections, on the one hand, on the other hand, Shema? And the answer is always, Lechtecha B'derech. The principle of Shema is Lechtecha B'derech, while you're on your way, while you're involved in life, which means that the principle is, we're never going to push aside life for Shema. Either we're going to do both at the same time, or push aside Shema for life. Which is the opposite of what we do with Tefillah. Tefillah, right, Amidah, has no rule of Lechtecha B'derech. Tefillah is Amodom, standard attention, put all your concentration on Kodesh Baruch Hu and forget about the world. So as far as Tefillah goes, we'd say, don't say hello and goodbye to your fellow. Don't greet people. As far as Tefillah would go, we would say, don't pick apples and don't do your work while you're doing Tefillah. As far as Tefillah, we would say, getting married doesn't matter. You have to stop and concentrate on Kodesh Baruch Hu. But for Shema, it's very different. Shema is Belechtecha B'derech. Shema is in the course of the community. So either you do the Shema while you're with the community, or you set Shema aside and go to the community. Different set of values for Amidah as opposed to Shema.
I thought the Chasam was also exempt from Amidah.
It might be said that in later sources, but in the way the Mishnah says it, it's in a perek that makes a distinction between Amidah and Tefillah. Our perek only talks about Shema, and the previous Mishnah actually said all these laws are not true for Amidah, if you remember, about picking the apples. It said there, Masha'ein Rasha'in Lasot Kein. But tefillah, what you're not allowed to do for tefillah, what you do for Shema, you don't do for tefillah. So the fact that later halakha went in a different direction, according to some, is not relevant for the Mishnah as a text of principles. I'll just say that as I say this, I hear the echo of my teacher's voice in my mind. I learned all this with Rav Dov Berkovitz, who was the son of Professor Eliezer Berkovitz, and Dov is the one that taught me to read the Mishnah as a text of principles and not just as a halakhic text. And he went on and on about how the Mishnah shows very clearly the difference between Tefillah on the one hand and Shema on the other hand. Yeah. So, we get to question three. What disagreement might we have in our Mishnah? That's, I guess, for Amiram.
Well, for certain reasons, Rav Rabban Gamliel was exempted himself, I guess, from this, or the opposite of exemption himself. I guess he would have been exempted for
obligated himself.
Right, obligated himself. It's kind of not a hard and fast rule, potentially. Then,
like, what about the students?
They were obligated and were asking him why he had taught one thing and wasn't practicing what he preached, so to speak.
Yeah, but I would add that you could read the students as simply asking a question. We don't understand.
Sure.
You taught us that you're exempt, but you're doing it anyway. But if we go deeper, we could read them as expressing a stance, that if you taught us that you're exempt, we think that means don't do it. Not just a question, but we have a stance. You said exempt. I assume that exempt means not obligated, and therefore you should not do it. Whereas he has the position that exempt does not mean not to, don't do it. It means you don't have to, but you can. So there might be a machloket here. What is the nature of a halachic exemption in principle? Does it mean you're exempt, you don't have to, you're not obligated, but the door is open to do it if you want? Or it might mean, according to the students, you're exempt, there's no mitzvah, and therefore there's no basis to do it. Don't do it. And, of course, these two approaches open up a world of philosophic discussion. Theology, sociology. And we just began a little bit to talk about that last time. But just to give a little bit of a hint or a taste, Rabban Gamliel, and this is Rabban Gamliel in character, going back to the very first Mishnah we learned, Rabban Gamliel leaves a certain degree of autonomy and freedom, if you want to call it liberalism, to the individual. I can do what I want. The halakha says exempt, and now I decide if I should do it or not do it. Whereas the students say, there's no room for personal autonomy. One size fits all. If halakha says you're exempt, therefore, you have no decision to make. Don't do it. That's a much more, let's say, conservative approach, much more constricting approach, we can call it. And there also can be theology involved here. We started to say a little bit last time. If I take an approach that says you're exempt, and that means don't do it, then basically I'm saying that all the meaning in mitzvot is found in the command. If you're not commanded, there's no meaning in it, there's no sense in it, it doesn't have any place in your life. Whereas if I say exempt means you can do it if you want, then I'm saying there's meaning in doing an act that's not commanded. There might be meaning. If you decide to do it, it has religious meaning. And that shows an understanding that perhaps mitzvot have value beyond the fact that they're commanded. And I tried to explain this last time with a number of metaphors. Mitzvot as army berets. You probably remember that I said that, right? You put a beret on your commander says, the only meaning in putting on a beret is obedience. Is subservience, is accepting your role as a soldier. You would never ever think to put the beret on when it's not commanded by the army. In the shower, while you're sleeping, while you're at home with your wife or your girlfriend or your daughter or your sister, why would you put on the beret? The only meaning is because you're commanded. If you're not commanded, it loses its meaning. And that's what the students say. If you're exempt, no sense to do it. And by the way, if you put your beret on when you're not commanded, you actually make a mockery of the army. It's not just that it makes no sense. It's almost an act of insubordination. You're putting it on. The only purpose in putting it on is when they say, but when they don't say, you're making light of their commands. So you shouldn't do a mitzvah when you're not commanded, if it's like an army beret. The only meaning is doing it when you're told. On the other hand, you might say that putting on, that doing mitzvot is like listening to music. Or the example I gave last time was seatbelts. We're commanded to wear seatbelts. But it makes a lot of sense, this mitzvah of seatbelts. It's not like the braid, it makes no sense. It's only because of obedience. The mitzvah of seatbelts is in order to advance our life, to further our health and well-being. And if there's some place in which you're not commanded to wear seatbelts, the law doesn't say to law them to put them on, you might say, ah, but I should do it anyway, because it makes sense, it's good for me. For example, I know that there's a law, at least I was told once in Israel, that when you're driving in reverse, you don't have to put a seatbelt on. In deference to people who want to turn it on and look. But it still makes sense to put it on if you can. It could save your life even then. So if mitzvot are like seatbelts for our own good, they make sense even beyond the fact that they're commanded, then you might say, exempt, but let me try my best to do it as much as I can, even when I'm exempt. And we'll go back to this a little bit more as this perek finishes up in the next half an hour.
Rabbi Gamliel, the same one that we addressed earlier?
Yes, the same Rabbi Gamliel at the beginning.
And at that point, if I recall, he tried to combine the principles of that base Hillel Meshamai basically presented.
To combine? Rabbi Gamliel was in the very first Mishnah.
Right, where the issue was whether he needed to actually sit to do the Kriya Shema, or he could do it on...
No, that was the third Mishnah, and Rabbi Gamliel wasn't in the third Mishnah.
Okay.
The first Mishnah was when Rabbi Gamliel held that the time for the Kriyat Shema of the evening is until the first light in the morning, and the rabbis came and accepted his principle in principle, but they added a rabbinic fence and said you only have until Chatzot. Until nighttime. And they say Chatzot, midnight. And you see there also, he provided much more leeway, much more personal prerogative than the Hachamim did. The Hachamim instituted a fence and tried to, and they had the position that we have to keep people far from Averah because they don't have the individual responsibility to do it themselves. Rabbi Gamliel puts much more responsibility on the individual than many of the sages do. Much more initiative, responsibility, and leeway. Yeah. Okay. So the last question, and I'm going to last one because the second to last one we just did, talking about theological arguments, the last one is, what point is brought up by the Rabbeinu Manoach as quoted by the Kesef Mishneh? And I assume that most people don't remember. The Kesef Mishneh is the commentary of Rav Yosef Karo on the Rambam's Mishneh Torah. I'll just say briefly, to give a large picture, that Rav Yosef Karo is the author of what famous work do we all know? Shulchan Aruch. Before he wrote the Shulchan Aruch, he wrote commentaries on the two major halakhic compendiums of all time. Is that a real word, compendiums?
Compendium.
Compendiums.
Mm-hmm.
Compendiums.
Compendia.
A compendia.
Plural.
Compendia, okay. So the first major halakhic compendium is, did I say it right?
Yes.
Is the Mishneh Torah of the Rambam. And the second is the Tor, the Arba Torim of Rabbeinu Yaakov, the son of the Rosh. Two major halachic compendia. And Rav Yosef Karo wrote a commentary on the first, and then a commentary on the second, and then summarized his commentary in the Shulchan Aruch. So on the Rambam, he wrote the Kesef Mishneh. On the Arba Torim, he wrote the Beit Yosef. And these are like major encyclopedic works. And he summarized them in very, very concise language for the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch is like a little pocket pamphlet you put in your pocket if you can't remember everything written in the Kesef Mishneh and the Beit Yosef. We think the Shulchan Aruch is a big book, but if you open a page, it's one word of the Shulchan Aruch and then 10 words of commentary, but written by other people. The Shulchan Aruch is a little pamphlet. It really is. Rabbi Nachman Miroslav says you should learn the whole Shulchan Aruch once a month. And he did. Because it's just reading over while you're driving, you know? To remind you of everything else.
Like driving a cart.
Don't just be allowed to download
it. Right. And by the way, don't think that Rabbi Nachman got to the stage in which he can learn the Shulchan Aruch once a month when he was an old man. He only lived to 39.
Wow.
Yeah. Unbelievable. Okay. So anyway, what did Rabbeinu Noach, as quoted in the Kishta Mishnah, say? He said that the exemption from Kriyat Shema for the Chatan is only for the nighttime Kriyat Shema, but not for the daytime Kriyat Shema. And that wasn't clear from other sources. Because for the daytime Shema, you're not tarud, you're not preoccupied with the upcoming mitzvah, because the mitzvah is not done in the daytime. But as far as the nighttime Kriyat Shema, whether it's the first night of your wedding, the second night, the third, the fourth, if you haven't done the Maaseh yet, you are tarud at night, so you're exempt from Kriyat Shema. That was Rabbeinu Manoach. And with that, we can go to the next Mishnayot. So, we'll put aside the quizzes.
Oh, you.
And we'll make sure that everyone has the material, so I think everyone has but Martin.
Yeah.
So to Martin, I have to give a question sheet, the two extra sources, and the Mishnah. Oh, I give you the original. That's not good. Okay. Okay, so we're going to open up the Mishnah. Yes, I do. You probably have it. I gave it at the end of last class. But in the meanwhile, you can use this one. It's fine. Okay. So, it's the top of a piece of paper. Paul, can you...
Thank
you. It looks like this. It's upside down. Looks like this. It has Perek Shlishi here. And we're doing the end of Perek Bet. Mishnayot Vav, Zayin, and Chet. Okay? Steve, do you have it?
Yeah.
Everyone's okay? Okay. So this is the Mishnah, right after the Mishnah we learned last week. That one was about Rabban Gamliel, that was exempt from saying Kriyat Shema on his wedding night, but said it anyway. And his students confronted him. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Now the next Mishnah. Rechatz Balayla Harishon Shemita Ishto. He washed on the first night that died his wife. This is Rabban Gamliel. And his wife died. And the first night, it doesn't say if it's after she died, but she wasn't buried yet, or she was already buried. But the first night, he washed. Amru lo talmidav. Said to him his students, and we recognize this pattern of students coming to him and asking about his behavior. Lo limadtanu rabbeinu, didn't you teach us, our rabbi, sha'avel asur lirchotz, that the mourner is asur lirchotz, is forbidden to wash? Right? That's a halakha that we have to this very day. During the 7 days of Shiva, you're not allowed to wash. And he washed when he was a mourner, the very first night when his wife passed away. Amar lehem, he said to them, Eini kishar kol adam. Eini, that's the word that Steve had in the quiz a few minutes ago. I'm not. Kishar. Kishar is two words. Kishar. I'm not like the rest. Shar is rest, the others, the remainder. I'm not like the rest of kol adam. I'm not like the rest of most people. Istanis ani. I am an istanis. Istanis is a Greek word which has entered Hebrew, and it means I am delicate. Istanis means delicate. There's probably a better word in English. Of delicate constitution. Anyone want to give me a better word for
sensitive?
Sensitive. So the halakha is, we all know, he knows, his students knows, everyone knows that you can't wash during the 7 days of Shiva. And he washed. And all his students saw it. And they protested and said, Rabbi, you taught us that an avail can't wash. And he said, I'm not like everyone else. I'm delicate. I'm sensitive. So first of all, we see that this Mishnah is clearly the same pattern as the previous Mishnah. He did something that didn't jive with the halakha. His students asked about it, and he gave an answer. So it's the same pattern, but it's a little bit different. Because there, all that happened is he was exempt, and he was machmir al atzmo. He was stringent on himself. He took upon himself a chumrah. Right? He was exempt, but he did it anyway. In our Mishnah, it's the opposite. He's not allowed to wash, and he does it anyway. He actually violates, it seems, a halakha. He doesn't just do a chumrah, he does a kula. He takes a leniency that he shouldn't be taking. And his students call him on it, and his answer is that I am an istinis. So, how do we read this?
When we're saying washing, we're just talking about taking a bath as opposed to washing in the morning before davening.
You can wash your hands to davening, and you must. But as far as washing the body, the whole body, even in cold water, he shouldn't have been doing that.
This is kind of, at least, firstly, more seems to be more on the lines of violating. You know, in the very first Mishnah that we did, where he says, no, actually, tells his sons, you have until, you know, daybreak, and that's true for all of these mitzvah. You know, so there it's more, you know, whether to be machmir or not. And in the other case from before, he's taking something on himself again. But here, I guess you're giving him the benefit of the doubt and saying he wouldn't flagrantly violate halacha. It certainly comes across that way, you know, more dramatically.
Yeah. It comes across, it seems to be that way.
On the line.
Yeah. And then the question is, so what are we going to do with this? How are we going to interpret it? So I was thinking to myself, kind of tongue-in-cheek, I can read it in three different ways. And just to be funny, or to be relevant, I'd call it the art scroll way, the reform way, and the middle, the modern orthodox way. And of course, I'm going to present my way as being the correct way, but I'm very aware that there are different ways to do it, and it might be that the art scroll way is correct, it might be that the reform way is correct, but I see my reading of it, the middle path, is the quote-unquote correct path. So what would the art scroll approach would be? The art scroll approach would be that he's basically saying to his students, don't you remember the halakha of the istinis? Don't you remember the halakha that I taught you, that if you're of delicate constitution, you're allowed to wash? In other words, they say he's doing something wrong, and he says, no, I'm not, you just forgot the halakha. Or in another version, didn't anyone teach you the halakha of istinis? But the idea is that there's a halakha on the books already, and I just am fitting myself into it. There's a halakha that says the istinis, the delicate person, is allowed to wash. And I'm doing it. I don't believe in that approach, but you could read it like that. Does everyone hear what I'm saying? The other pole, which for the sake of a laugh I'm calling the reform approach, would be to say that there is no such category of istinis until now. And Rabban Gamliel is basically making leniency for himself. Right, the halakha is that you're not allowed to wash. And his students catch him washing. So he says, for me this is a separate category. I'm different. And I would call that a cynical approach, which I don't think is right either. There's a two poles. But the way that I would suggest to read it is a middle ground, and I think makes a lot of sense, which is that Rabban Gamliel is telling the students that there's not just a rule that you're not allowed to wash, there's a value behind the rule. And the value is that the mourner is commanded to engage in activities or to refrain from activities in order to reflect the proper psychological mindset of the mourner, which is sadness, which is a degree of discomfort. However, the mourner is not commanded to engage in activities or to refrain from activities that cause him tremendous discomfort. The value is to refrain from pleasure and to create a certain degree of discomfort. That's the reason for the law of the Na'ara Wash. Rabban Gamliel says, what's central is not the rule, it's the value. And for me, were I to apply the rule, it would pervert the value. Because I am so delicate in my constitution, if I were not to wash, it wouldn't create a situation of a slight discomfort. It would cause me great pain. And that's not what the halakha wanted. So what he's saying is, apply the halakha not just according to its hard and fast rule, apply it to its value, which I taught you when we learned this, he's saying to his students. Now see how you apply that to changing circumstances. And I think that's very important. And that, by the way, just David might remember this, I'm actually paraphrasing from an article written about Eliezer Berkowitz, who was the father of the rabbi I learned this from, who explained that halakha is not about rules, it's about values. And when you have a rule in the books, the proper path is not necessarily to apply the rule blindly in other cases, to find the value behind the rule and then apply the value to cases. And that's exactly what is done as the halakha developed in these laws of mourning, specifically vis-a-vis, I'm giving you an example here, specifically the mourning for Beit HaMikdash during the 3 weeks and the 9 days. You know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because the Shulchan Aruch says clearly you cannot wash during the 9 days. It's like mourning for a relative. Why in our day does everyone wash? Because the halakha authorities the past 30 years said that the law of not washing was promulgated in a period when people only washed once a week. And not washing for 9 days was refraining from special pleasure, but it wasn't a great discomfort. And our day, when times have changed and people wash every day, to refrain from washing for 9 days would be an unbelievable discomfort that is not what the halakha had in mind. And therefore, for us to today, legitimately and authentically practice the halakha as it was meant, we should wash, but not on hot water. Or not wash our whole body. Or not wash with a lot of soap. There are different variations in the different poskim of our generation. But what happened in these laws of mourning for the Beit HaMikdash, the poskim of our generation applied these laws not as rules, and I'm using philosophical language, Eliezer Berkowitz language, they applied them not as rules but as values. And that actually goes back right here. That's Rabban Gamliel is saying, it's not a rule, it's a value. And find the value behind the rule and then apply it in different circumstances. So it's not that he's making a special exemption for himself out of the thin air. And it's not that he's just applying a rule that always existed. It's a middle path. He's applying something that always existed, but it's not the rule. It's the value that was behind the rule.
Is this an extensible argument? And the reason I ask goes back to Friday night, Shabbos night, when we had good rain, when we had, our family had dinner here, Shabbos dinner here, and my wife is going, I'm not going out there, oops, in the rain. But on the other hand, if you don't go, you starve, so we have to go, and my goodness, I need an umbrella in this awful weather. It's Shabbos. We've lost the value for, you know, which argument, is it extensible?
First of all, I just learned a new word. Extensible means applicable to different circumstances?
It does, yeah.
Okay.
Compendia.
Yeah, I'm doing good today. I'm learning something. Everyone knows intuitively that the approach that says don't apply rules, apply values, it can bring you down a slippery slope.
Yeah.
That it's dangerous, right? That's clear. Applying rules is not dangerous on one level, just to do what the rule says. It's dangerous on another level because it causes perhaps a perversion. But at least everyone can do the same thing and not have the slippery slope of that we've been talking about. So in order to avoid the slippery slope, one of the easiest things that we can say, and it's true, is that the directive, don't apply rules, apply values, doesn't apply to us in the room. It applies to the halakhic deciders of the generation.
Professor Berkowitz wasn't speaking to us when he said, make sure you understand halakha as values and not as rules. He was talking to the halakhic deciders of his generation. That's answer number one. Number two, in your particular case, it doesn't apply. You're not allowed to open an umbrella on Shabbat. What can I do?
Had I had this discussion with you last week, I might have nodded at my wife and said, fine.
Well, then it's good that you brought it up, because that means I'd be misunderstood. Right? You don't know the value.
I wouldn't have missed you. The umbrella wouldn't have helped. It was blowing pretty hard.
Yep.
Let me give...
you've broken your umbrella.
I remember a case, I don't remember all the details, that there was a group of Hester boys, soldiers in the army in Lebanon, during, and this goes back to, must be 82. And they were in a mutzav, they were in a fortress in Lebanon on Shabbat, and didn't have anything to eat. They had very little to eat. And a truck came, an army truck came on Shabbat with all the provisions for Shabbat. Came an hour late, right? So the question is, are they allowed to eat the food that comes? And there's good reasons not to. It's called Maaseh Shabbat. It was brought to them through a violation of Shabbat. And also came from outside of the Tchum, outside of the Alpaim, the 2,000 cubits that you can't travel in. You can't even walk in. Came outside of the Tchum, therefore it's Muktzeh. Anything that comes outside of the Tchum is Muktzeh on Shabbat. So later the question came to Rav Lichtenstein, which I don't know what they did, but what should have they done? And Rav Lichtenstein gave a whole shiur, gave a whole discussion on the fact that they should have eaten the food. Why? Because he weighed different values in halakha. He weighed the value of Onig Shabbat, of the joy of Shabbat, which is a value. He weighed the value of morale in a war situation. And he came to the conclusion that they should have eaten the food. So he weighed values and not just rules. But that's not something that I could have done. I couldn't have weighed those factors. Okay.
So your answer, I guess, as far as...
in other words, don't take on my wife.
Elias Berkowitz's point is that he is speaking to post-game. Not directly, at least.
Right. He's speaking to us as far as how we should understand topic. Things, but practically, right. Practically he's speaking to post-game and not to us. Right? We don't have the broad shoulders and the grand vision of all the different values involved.
Just like we take any question of that isn't clear to us as to what to do, you have to ask the rabbi.
Yeah.
I mean, that's...
And what the rabbi, in the best case scenario, has to weigh is not just one rule against another. It's to weigh all of Talmudic literature and all the different values that might be involved there. Okay, so Rabban Gamliel is serving as a model of how values are applied and not just rules. Let's see if there's anything else I want to say about Rabban Gamliel there before we go on to the next case.
While you're looking, can I just say, I've studied this before, mm-hmm. And it's enormously different to just read the Mishnahs one after another. Because
right. When
you end one about Rabbi Gamliel and start the next one about Rabbi Gamliel, it's just so, as you pointed out, I mean, we see exactly, you know, it's the same conversation, yeah. It's continued.
Right, it was in the Gemara, you have 2 weeks of commentary in the
yeah.
middle.
I mean, there's it's totally disconnected.
Right. That's, again, the story of Mishnah as a literary text that hangs together with its own theme that it develops.
It was written that way,
obviously.
Invention of the...
Yeah. Okay. Let's just see if anything else we want to add here. I don't want to skip something. Okay, let's go on. Mishnah Zayin. Ukshemet Tavi Avdo Kibel Alav Tanchumin. When died Tavi, his servant, accepted upon him Tanchumin. Tanchumin means condolences. but it's a specific legal type of condolences. It is when we bury the body at a funeral, we move a certain distance from the grave, and we line up in two parallel lines, with the people in each line facing each other, facing in, and the mourner walks slowly between the two lines, and the people on either side slowly, one after the other, say to the mourner, "Amakom yinachem otcha b'toch shar evlei Tzion b'Yerushalayim." May God comfort you among the mourners for Tzion and Yerushalayim. So that's a halachic category, that there's this ceremony, this mandated ceremony of Tanchumin when one of your seven relatives dies. Right? Sister, mother, brother, father, son, daughter, and spouse. The seven, the Shivata Krovim, the seven Krovim that you have to mourn for. So you have to accept Tanchumin. The people who are at the funeral have to get up and stand in these two lines and you have to pass through.
Each person says the phrase to them?
Each person says it. So, your slave, your servant, is not one of those seven relatives. And we're talking about here about Tavi, who is a well-known slave of Rabban Gamliel. He wasn't even Jewish, by the way. Not just that he's not a family, he's not even Jewish. On the other hand, we have to know the laws of non-Jewish slaves. To become a non-Jewish slave of a Jew, you have to go through a partial conversion process. I don't know if you know this. It's interesting stuff. But anyway, when a non-Jew becomes a slave of a Jew, he becomes partially converted, which means he is commanded to do all the negative mitzvot and some of the positive ones. He's commanded to do the positive ones that are not time-bound. But the time-bound ones he's not commanded to do, which basically means he has all the mitzvot that a woman has. She's exempt from positive time-bound mitzvot. That's a non-Jewish slave. When a non-Jewish slave is freed, he's freed by finishing the conversion process and becoming a full Jew, in which he now has to do even those positive time-bound mitzvot that he wasn't until this point obligated in. So anyway, Tavi is the non-Jewish slave of Rabban Gamliel, and he died. And what happened is that Rabban Gamliel accepted Tanchumin at the funeral. Now let's be let's be careful. Accepted Tanchumin. What do you mean accepted Tanchumin? It means Rabban Gamliel asked his guests to stand in two lines so he can walk through. What do you mean accept Tanchumin? Everyone's going to go home because he's a slave. So if he accepted Tanchumin, it means that he asked the people to stand in two lines and he walked through, even though this man is not Jewish and he's not a relative. So what do you think the student said?
What are you doing?
Right, what are you doing? You've gone too far. I mean, you said Shema on your wedding night, and then you washed when your wife died. So, Amru lo Talmidav, said to him his students, Lo limatanu rabbeinu, she'ein mikablin tanchumin al havadim. Didn't you teach us, our rabbi, that one does not accept tanchumin for slaves? What is he going to say now? Amar lehem, he said to them, Ein tavi avdi kishar kol avadim. Is not tavi my slave like the rest of the slaves? Kasher haya, he was kosher. He's not like the rest of the slaves. He was a good guy. Ah, so what? The halakha says that you don't accept tanchumin for slaves. What are you going to do? So Rabban Gamliel has really gone much further in this case than the other cases. Remember the first case, he simply did something he was exempt from. Fine. The second case, he did something he wasn't supposed to do. But in the third case, he asks others to do something they're not supposed to do. He's really obligating his students and his friends to do something the halakha does not ask them to do. So that's really problematic. Let's see, what else can we say about this?
What does he mean by kasher haya?
What does he mean by kasher haya? Very good question. He was kosher. In other words, he was a good, upstanding individual, and he was so close to my family, and we were so much in the same wavelength that I view him as a family member, so I want tanchumin. But still, the question is, you know, can you demand such a thing? In any case, can you decide who's kosher and who's not? When the halacha says that ein mikablin tanchumim al avadim. So I want to read you some stories about Tavi, the servant of Rabban Gamliel. He's well known in the Mishnah, in the Tosefta. So I copied for myself some of the material about him. So I'll just tell you that in Masechet Megillah, the Yerushalmi brings that it's forbidden to teach Torah to a slave. You know what Rabban Gamliel did? Yeah, he did. He taught Torah to his slave. And what did he say when he was told, but we don't teach Torah to a slave? He said, he's not like the rest of the slaves, he's kosher. He's a kosher guy. There's another one. Look at this one. This is in Masechet Smachot. It says that Tavi put on tefillin, which is a positive time-bound mitzvah. Positive time-bound mitzvah that women and slaves are exempt from. So the student said to Rabban Gamliel, Lo limatanu rabbeinu, didn't you teach us, our rabbi, sha'avadim petorim min tefillin, that slaves are exempt from tefillin? What did Rabban Gamliel say? Amar lehem, ein tavi avdi kashar avadim kasherhu. Tavi is not like the rest of the slaves, he's kasher. And just like a woman can, perhaps, take upon herself positive time down mitzvot, that's a whole other section, question, but the same thing with a slave, says Rabban Gamliel. He can take upon positive time down mitzvot if he's up to it, if he's kasher. So anyway, there's a lot of stories about Rabban Gamliel and Tavi, his servant.
Is he saying he converted him earlier than later?
If he had converted him to be a full Jew, he wouldn't be a slave anymore. He wouldn't be called an Eved. He would be a full Jew.
A Jew can't be a slave? I mean, if they committed like a robbery?
So that's a different category. That's an Eved Ivri. That's someone who's born a Jew, and because he owes money, etc., he can be indentured for 6 years. But here we have a non-Jewish slave who's indentured for life, unless his master decides to free him. And freeing him means allowing him to complete the conversion ceremony to become a full Jew, and then a full Jew can't be a slave. He can only be an indentured servant for 6 years. So Tavi remained a servant, a slave all his life, but he put on tefillin and he learned Torah, and now tanchumim were accepted for him. Okay. So we have now all the background. We have Rabban Gamliel saying Shema on his wedding night, Rabban Gamliel washing when his wife dies, and Rabban Gamliel accepting tanchumim for his servant. And we now come face to face with the ideological issue.
He's going to be stoned soon, isn't he?
No, he's not. He's still Rabban Gamliel. So the last Mishnah sums everything up. And it says like this. Chatan im ratza likrot kriyat shma belayla rishon koe. A chatan, if he wants to read kriyat shma on the wet night of his wedding, can do so. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel omer, and don't get Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel mixed up with Rabban Gamliel. Right, I gave out a list of the different generations of Rabban Gamliel's family a while ago, last week. Anyone have it in front of you? Presumably to Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel. The names repeat themselves. It's hard to know who is who. Rabban Gamliel that we've been working with. So Rabban Shimon Gamliel is a later generation there, right? Looks like this. Right, so Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel. Right, there were two of them, but we're looking at Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel here.
Is this vertical? Is this like genealogically vertical?
Yes, this is a generation after generation. One is a son of the, usually the son of the son of the son. So anyway, it's all in the family. They were the Nisi'im, the presidents of the Sanhedrin. And the Tanakhama says, Hatan im ratza likrot kriyat shema b'layla rishon koreh. which obviously is reflective of the position of Rabban Gamliel that we had back in Mishnah that he read the first night. But then it says, Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, who is someone else, says, Lo chol harotze litol at Hashem yitol. Not everyone who wants to take up the name, litol, like nitilat yadayim, means to lift your hands. Not everyone who wants to lift up the name may lift it up. That's a literal translation. Not everyone who wants to lift up the name can lift it up. So it's clear that there are two opinions here in the Mishnah. The first opinion reflects Rabban Gamliel, you can do what you want, at least as far as Kriyat Shema, and apparently it's a general endorsement, more or less, of Rabban Gamliel's more liberal, more autonomous position that you're allowed in different circumstances, we haven't defined exactly what they are, to take things upon yourself to be a little bit different, whether it's the case of the Tanchumim, whether the case of washing, whether the case of Kriyat Shema. There is a certain degree of liberalism and of spectrum of possibilities, again, without defining exactly what we mean by that. And to a large degree, it might be based, I'm just summing things up, based on approach of rule, of values opposed to rules, and on a theological approach that understands mitzvot like seatbelts, that it's not just that the value of mitzvot is in obedience, but the mitzvot reveal certain values, and then you have certain a leeway in deciding how to apply them. But what about Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel? To a certain degree, he's expressing the opinion of the students, who are circumspect about Rabban Gamliel's taking liberties. They're always trying to bring their teacher back into a framework. Right? We'll spend the next 20 minutes before, perhaps 15 minutes before we go, figuring out what Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel was saying. There are two possibilities of understanding what he's saying. I'll just say it once again. Not everyone who wants to take upon himself the name can take it. There are two questions we'll discuss in understanding what Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel meant. The first question is simple. When I say, not everyone can do X, I can be interpreted in two different fashions. I might mean, no one can do it. Or I might mean, some people can do it, but some people can't. Right? When I say, not everyone can do something. Sometimes that's a way of speaking, which means no one can do it. But other times it means there are some people but can, but some people can't. So that's the question here. Rabban Shimon Gamliel, is he saying that no one can take the name, and somehow that's a metaphor for saying Shema when you're exempt? Or is he saying some people can, but some people can't? If he's taking the first approach, saying you can't do it, then he's objecting to Rabban Gamliel, and he's taking the approach of the students. You can't do it. He did it. We hold you can't do it. If you're exempt, then you can't do it. And in general, it would be about taking less liberties and having a more circumscribed approach to mitzvot. Mitzvot is obedience opposed to mitzvot as seatbelts. So perhaps Rabban Shimon Gamliel is simply nullifying across the board Rabban Gamliel's approach. No one can do it. If you're not commanded, don't do it. But he might be saying not everyone can do it. Some people can, some people can't. In other words, he'd be saying Rabban Gamliel can do it, but don't everyone else act like him. Some people can do it, but some people can't. And there's some people that can. I guess it's Rabban Gamliel, who's the gadol of his generation. But don't use him as an example. Don't everyone go making up your own halakha. So that's two ways of understanding Rabban Shimon Gamliel. Is he completely arguing with Rabban Gamliel, or just limiting Rabban Gamliel and saying he can do it, but not everyone else can do it? That's question number one that we'll discuss. Okay? Question number two is, what is the meaning of this metaphor to lift up the name? Why is that a description of saying Shema? And there'll be two possibilities here in understanding this question. Ready? One possibility is to lift up the name means to take God's name on your lips. It means to say God's name. Not everyone can say those words, only... The other possibility, to take the name, means to take upon yourself the name of a righteous person. To act as if you have a name. So what I just said is that we're going to discuss two questions. And each of the two questions has two possible approaches. And the next thing I'll say is of the two questions we discussed, that I put on the table right now, with each having a two possible approach, there's a correspondence between A of 1 and A of 2, and B of 1 and B of 2. Where, how does the correspondence go? It goes as follows. Are you ready? Again, if I'm not making clear, I can say it again. If you take the approach that Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel is saying, you can't do it, not everyone can do it means no one can do it, then he's probably holding that taking the name means taking God's name. And he's saying, you can't take God's name unless you're commanded. When you're not commanded, you can't say God's name. Something like a bracha levatala, taking God's name in vain. The other correspondence is, if Rabbi Shimon Gamliel is saying that not everyone can do it, but some people can, then what it means by the name is taking upon yourself the name of a pious person. Some people can do it if they are indeed pious people. But if you're not on that level, then you can't do it. So you, while you're thinking, I'm just going to write that on the board.
I'm going to write, this is Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, and we said there were two, question one was,
not everyone, or no one.
Everyone? Not everyone, or no one. Right. And the other issue was, number two, the issue was the name. Name of a pious person or name of God. So if it's the name of God, not everyone can take the name of God, it means no one can do it. If it's a matter of not everyone can take upon himself the mantle of a pious person, well, it means only if you're a pious person. Not everyone, but some people can. So there's a one-to-one correspondence here. I might put the two over here.
And now I'm just going to put a code word on the board that'll help us to talk about this.
I'm going to call this approach the sociological approach. Sociological. I'm going to call this approach the theological approach.
Okay, if it's not everyone, but some people can, and who can, if you're a pious person who already has a, if you're a card-carrying member of the pious society, then you can take upon yourself things that other people can't. That's a sociological approach. Whereas the theological approach is that, in principle, you can't take upon yourself, you can't say the name of God. Rabban Gamliel said you can. This approach says you can't. Across the board, no one can do it. Theologically, it's a different approach to mitzvot.
So now, let's see some sources and put everything together.
Can I ask something real quick?
Of course.
To me, that whole distinction between not everyone being, having two different meanings, it doesn't come across in a way. Because nowhere else does that verbiage come in that we've hit so far.
So we'll see sources right now that do. This very minute. The Tosefta. I gave out about half an hour ago the Tosefta. And the Tosefta begins on the previous page, but not in order not to waste paper, I just wrote at the top of my handwriting the words from the previous page. This is Tosefta in Masechet Ta'anit, Perek Aleph. The Pei Aleph is Perek Aleph. And it's number 7. And it says, Ezehu Yahid. Who is an individual? And that word individual means who is in the category of the special individuals of the community. Who is a Yahid? Who is a, how do we say in English, who is a line of Judah? Whatever. Rabban Shimon ben Lazar, and Lazar is a form of the word Elazar, which they just can't pronounce the Aleph, so it gets lost. Rabbi Shimon ben Lazar Omer, Aleph of is Omer, Lo chol haotze, recognize that language from our Mishnah, Lo chol haotze, lasot etzmo yachid, talmid chacham, ose. Translation, who is an outstanding individual, who is yachid, who is a card-carrying special person? Rabbi Shimon ben Lazar says, not everyone who wants to make himself into yachid or into a talmid chacham can do so. Ose, first word of the next line, not everyone can ose, not everyone can do so. Ela im ken, manuhu beitin ala tzibor, except if appointed him the court over the congregation. In other words, there are apparently certain halachot, or certain ways of acting, that are only for special people. And who's allowed to act in that special fashion? Only if the Beit Din appointed you. Just to give you an example, and I don't mean to embarrass anyone, who's allowed to sit up on the podium by the ark? Only if you're elected by the congregation as a president, right? If you're not, you can't. So, who's the yachid? You can't just make yourself into a yachid or a talmid chacham. You have to be appointed. You have to be given smicha. You have to be elected by the congregation. You have to have a card carrier. You have to have a document in order to be a yachid.
So, there's yachid because I have the commonly accepted documents that say I am.
Mm-hmm.
There's yachid because I have the recognition of people.
So here it says that the Beit Din has appointed him. Has to be a formal process, apparently.
Is the word yachid in this sentence?
In my handwriting. Ezehu yachid. Who is a yachid? Who is a, quote, yachid? Who's an outstanding individual? Now in the middle of the second line.
What is that second letter? I'm sorry. What's yud?
Het yud dalet.
Thanks.
No problem. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel Omer, we recognize that name. That's Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel from Mishnah. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel Omer, Devar Shehu Shel Tsar, a matter that is a pain. The word Shehu, we usually write it with the Aleph at the end. Shehu, that is. A matter that is a pain. Harutze lasot atzmo yachid ose. Anyone who wants to make himself into yachid can make himself into a talmid chacham ose. V'talov alav bracha. And may blessing come upon him. In other words, the opening statement was you can't make yourself into yachid unless you get an appointment by the Beit Din. But Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says that if it's a matter of pain, you can make yourself into a yachid.
Meaning?
Good question. This is Masechet Tanit, about fasting. Mm. The central part of the Masechet is about fasting for rain. The Mishnayot at the beginning talk about the following. When the rain doesn't fall in the rainy season, we start davening for rain. At a certain point, if the rain doesn't come and time is going on, we start fasting. But at the first fast, not everyone fasts. Who fasts? The Yechidim. Special people fast at the beginning of the fast. If that doesn't work, then the whole congregation fasts. So who are the Yechidim? The first opinion said only if you're appointed can you fast. But says Rabban Shimon Gamliel, something of pain like fasting, anyone who wants to join the Yechidim can join. if it's a matter of pain. But I'm reading on now. The third word of the fourth line, after the comma, Devar shehu shel shevach, something that's a matter of praise. In other words, it's not difficult, but it just gives you honor, like sitting on the stage by the ark. That lo kol harutzeh atzmo yechid oseh. Not everyone who wants to be a yechid can be, or to be a talmid chacham can be. Ele im kein manuhu beitin al hatzibor. Except if the beitin appointed him over the tzibor. So now, I'll just summarize the Tosefta that we just learned, and then we'll apply it to the Mishnah that we learned 10 minutes ago. Tosefta has two opinions. The basic subject of the Tosefta is being a yechid, being a talmid chacham, having a special status in the eyes of the community, which sometimes gives you special acts to do or places to sit or deference from the community, whatever it is. The first opinion, Rabbi Shimon ben Lazar says, you can't do these things unless you are appointed by the Beit Din. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel says, if it's a matter of shevach, of praise, that you get honor, you can't do these things unless you're appointed. But if it's a matter of tsar, of pain, like fasting, you can fast whenever you want, you can join the Yechidim, and no one's going to say anything. It's fine. That's the Tosefta. Now we apply the Tosefta to our Mishnah. In our Mishnah we had Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel. And he said there, going to the Mishnah, he had said...
And we think it's the same one.
It's the same person, yeah. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel Omer, lo kol harotze litol et Hashem yitol. Not everyone who wants to take the name can take it. We can add to that now our next sentence, except if the Beit Din appointed them. Right? And why, so then, is Shema matter of Shevach or matter of Tsar? Is it like fasting or is it like praise? Just apply the Tosefta. It's like praise. Because if it was tsar, then he would say, anyone can do it. But if it's praise, it gives you a little bit of credit in other people's eyes to say Shema when everyone else is not saying Shema. If it's praise, then you can't do it, but you can if you're appointed. So that means that we've now learned that the proper way to understand is not the theological approach, but the sociological approach. What Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel is saying is not everyone can do it, but some people can. And what is it, what are we talking about? We're talking about taking upon yourself the name of a pious person. Acting like a yechid. You can act like a yechid if you've been appointed, but you can't if you haven't been appointed. Why? Because the community works according to certain norms. You can't just act like a big shot unless you've been appointed, unless you have a, like we say in Hebrew, unless you have in your pocket a, if you're a card-carrying big shot. You have to be appointed. So that really tells us how to understand our Mishnah. So we're going to, at this point, cross out number one and go to number two. So to summarize everything now, Rabban Gamliel read Shema when he was exempt. And then comes Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel and simply clarifies that Rabban Gamliel's behavior was okay, but it's not for everyone. Only if you've been appointed as a yechid can you do what he did. And therefore, we have altogether three opinions. No, we don't have three opinions. No, just have two. The students of Rabban Gamliel said you can't say the Shema when you're exempt. You can't. Rabban Gamliel said you can. And Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel clarified that you can, but only when you've been appointed as a special person. That's the whole story.
And you started to say there were three, so you could say, well, why is it clear that Rabbi Gamliel doesn't go beyond?
Right, right. But you know what? I didn't say it. It's pretty good. Right, but that would be going on the limb, because it's not clear that Rabban Gamliel disagrees with Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel. He might.
Except that there's two opinions given. I mean, usually if there's two different things said, they're different in some way.
Or the second is a clarification of the first. Now, again, you're not wrong. There are at least two opinions. Right? One opinion, the students say you can't say Kriyat Shema when you're exempt. And the second opinion being you can, but only when you're appointed. And David says it might be, that's the third opinion. Rabban Gamliel himself might be saying anyone could do it. But there's no proof that he's saying anyone could do it. Okay. Now, don't cross out side number one too quickly. And we'll end with side number one. And for this we have to go to the Yerushalmi. Okay? Yeah, right, so we have to go quickly. Wives are waiting. So the Yerushalmi brings our Mishnah at the very top, and I'm going to read the Mishnah. And it says, Chatan im rotze likrot et shma b'layla rishon koreh. A chatan, if you want to read the Shema the first night, read. That's Rabban Gamliel's opinion. And then it says Rashbag, Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, right, who we know from the Mishnah, Omer, Lo chola rotze litol et Hashem yitol. Not everyone wants to take upon himself the name can take it. Okay? That's our Mishnah. And then the first thing that happens in the Yushalmi, in the Gemara, is it brings the Braita we just read from the Tosefta. Okay? It's 95% the same language. It says Tani, which means we bring a Braita. Kol davar shu shel tsar, everything that's a matter of pain. Kol harutze lasot atzmo yachid oseh, anyone who wants to make himself into a yachid, does. Talmid chacham oseh, into a talmid chacham, you can do it. V'tavo ala bracha, and blessing should come upon it. Right? V'chol davar shu shel shevach, but everything is a matter of praise. Lo chol harotze lasot atzmo yachid oseh, talmid chacham oseh, not everyone who would make himself into a yachid does it, into a talmid chacham can do it. Ela im kein minu oto, except if they appointed him, parnas al tzibur. Yes, he was appointed a leader over the tzibur. 95% the language of the Tosefta, a different word here or there, same idea. So that means that the Yerushalmi, the Talmud Yerushalmi, is bringing our Tosefta to explain our Mishnah and explain it just like we did the second side of the board. That Braita explains the Mishnah. Okay? But the Yerushalmi goes on to the bottom of the page where I have my bracket there, 5 lines from the bottom, 6 lines from the bottom.
Of the middle column.
Of the middle column. The middle column, that's the Yerushalmi, everything else is the commentary. Thank you. Tani Chizkiya. Chizkiya learned in a Braita. Kol mishu patur midavar vosehu nikra hidyot. Says Chizkiya, anyone who is exempt from a matter and does it is called a hidyot. Hedyot can be translated as a simpleton or as an idiot.
I thought it's also a designation for certain kohanim, right?
Right. If there's a kohen gadol and a kohen hedyot, anyone who's on a lower level is a hedyot. It means normal, as when it's compared to a kohen gadol. Mm-hmm. But hedyot in general means like an ama aretz, a simpleton, someone that doesn't know anything, an ignoramus, an idiot. So Chizkiya is brought by the Talmud Yerushalmi in its commentary on our Mishnah with its very short statement, anyone who does something he's exempt is called an idiot. So that is not what we've been saying until now. Till now we've been saying if you do something that you're exempt from, you are violating community norms. That's a sociological matter. You're taking upon yourself a mantle that you're not allowed to. Chizkiya says, no, it's a completely different story. If you do what you're not commanded, it's not a sociological problem. You're not violating community norms. You're an idiot. And the way I'd interpret that is it means that if you put on an army beret in the shower, you have no understanding of what's going on. Right? It's a violation, not sociological, but of theological. Right? No one should do what he's exempt from. Not
not everyone, but some people should. Some people can, some people can't. But no one can do it, because if you're exempt, and you do something you're exempt, then you've taken the name of God in vain. You've completely misunderstood what this matter is about. Chezkiah holds that mitzvot are like an army beret. It's only meaningful if you're commanded. If you're not commanded, then you've misunderstood the whole system by doing the matter. And although I can't prove it, I would claim that Chezkiah brought here in the Talmud is not just an independent statement, it's an explanation of how to understand Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel. Because when Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel said, not everyone who wants to take upon the name can take it, he means no one can take it, because there's no such thing as taking a name upon yourself, taking God's name of your own volition. Either you're commanded or you're not. If you're not commanded to say Kriyat Shema, then you don't say it. And the same thing with any other mitzvah. If you're not commanded to put on tefillin, you don't put on tefillin. I'm thinking about Tavi, or I'm thinking about the woman. So let's sum it up now. Let's sum up everything we have. We have Rabban Gamliel. Right. And this goes back to what David, now we'll go back to what David said earlier and we'll sum everything up. Sum everything up.
Sum up everything. We have the students. We have Rabban Gamliel. And we have Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel.
We know what all of them said. The students said to Rabban Gamliel, why did you
include Chizkiah?
I'm going to include that under Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel. I'm going to put here the Tosefta and Chizkiah as two different interpretations of Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel. Okay. And I'm going to say as follows. So the student said you shouldn't say Shema when you're exempt, right? Rabban Gamliel said Shema when he's exempt. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel said not everyone should say Shema when you're exempt. Then we had two interpretations of what did Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel mean. The Tosefta's approach was some people can, some people can't. And it was a community matter, a sociological matter. Rabbi Chizkiah said that you can't. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel meant not everyone can do it, means you can't do it. So now, let's see the relationship between Rabban Shimon Gamliel and the students. And it depends on which approach we take to Rabban Shimon Gamliel. If we take the approach of Shimon Gamliel according to Chizkiah, you can't do it, then it's the same thing as the students. You can't do it. If Rabban Shimon Gamliel's approach is the Tosefta, that sometimes you can, sometimes you can't, it's not the students. It might be Rabban Gamliel. So I'll put the arrows like this. Chizkiah brings us back to the students. The Tosefta might bring us back to Rabban Gamliel. Should I say anything again? And practically speaking, what does this mean? Practically speaking, let's say your wedding night, Shema. The students say, don't say it. Rabban Gamliel says, you can say it. When he said, you can say it, did he mean only some people can? That's Rabban Gamliel according to the... Rabban Shimon Gamliel is only interpreting Rabban Gamliel. It's like the Tosefta is the same thing. Or perhaps Rabban Gamliel said, everyone can say it. And that's an opinion that Rabban Shimon Gamliel disagrees with. Rabban Shimon Gamliel says, some people can say it. Oh, wait a second. It says some people can say it. Right. He said no one can say it. He said everyone can say it. Okay, great. Let me say that again, right? Let me say that again. Shema on your wedding night. The students say don't say it. Rabban Gamliel said it. Rabban Shimon Gamliel says not everyone. what did Rabbi Shmuel Gamliel mean? Either he meant that some people can and some people can't, which might be what Rabbi Gamliel meant, or Rabbi Shmuel Gamliel is saying no one can say it, which means it's arguing against Rabbi Gamliel and agreeing with the students.
And would you, do you take the presentation in the Yerushalmi as where there's just the stark contrast of Rabbi Gamliel and Shimon ben Gamliel to be a disagreement?
The Yerushalmi is not edited to the level that the Bavli is. It's usually just a collection of statements and you don't know what the connection is, and you don't know. I'm making an assumption, and I admit that most of the commentators don't read it like me, but I'm convinced that that's the way to read it.
Just getting back to the Yerushalmi, it appears to me that there is a lot of discussion about the Tosefta interpretation of Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, and a very brief concluding comment about Chizkiyah.
Right, that's true.
So perhaps there's a sense of priorities and perhaps a sense of significance by addressing the first one in depth and the second one briefly.
Could be. Could be. But no. Okay, so Chag Pesach Kasher V'Sameach.
You too. Thank you very much.
So next week there's